Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw an eye, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. And good afternoon to everyone. And thank you to everybody here at Bellevue West High School for hosting us here today. We will begin by introductions from the members of the court. I am Mike Hevekin, and I am the Chief Justice. And now, by order of seniority as to their service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good afternoon. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle, good morning. Good afternoon.
Stephanie Stacy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff Walker.
Jonathan Papik, good afternoon.
John Price.
Thank you, members of the court, and I've now turned on my microphone, so hopefully you can hear me. Our first case this afternoon is Badawi versus Albin, and counsel, Mr. Anderson, are you here today? Yes. And Ms. Kano, and is it Ms. Horovitch?
Horvatich,
excuse me. Thank you very much. Everybody's here, and do any counsel have any questions? Do any of you have any questions before we begin? No questions. And counsel for Appley, you are going to split your time 5 minutes each. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And you realize you have to keep track of that time. Very good. With that, Mr. Anderson, you may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Zach Anderson, and I'm the attorney for the appellant, Saeed Badawi. At this time, I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. The district court erred in affirming the appeals tribunal decision because JBS, as the employer, failed to meet its burden of proof to show that the appellant engaged in misconduct. Additionally, the district court erred in affirming the appeals tribunal decision that the appellant was discharged for misconduct, disqualifying him from benefits. The appellant was denied unemployment benefits for a period of 14 weeks. He appeared for the hearing in front of the administrative law judge, and he was the only person to attend. He was the only person to present evidence, not JBS, not the Department of Labor. JBS knew about the hearing. They were provided adequate notice of this hearing, and they still chose not to attend. The appellant was a meat cutter for JBS. It was a dirty job. It was a gross job. It's difficult. It's unpleasant.
What do we know about the appellant's job duties?
His job duties essentially were there were large animals, namely cows, that he was expected to cut top to bottom, left to right.
Where do we see that in the record? The particular job duties of his position?
Yes, Your
Honor.
Other
than using a knife, what do we know?
Your Honor, forgive me, at this time I can't seem to recall that in the transcript. However, the Department of Labor, in its also in its argument to the district court, did acknowledge what type of labor he was doing with these large animals, with these knives. We know that initially he was hired to be a meat euthanizer, and he did also testify that in all of his positions he did use a knife. And then it was in this position that he was expected to be able to cut these large animals as a meat cutter.
Thank you.
You began your argument by framing it in two parts, one of which was your opponent failed to meet its burden of proof. Are you speaking of burden of proof in terms of a burden of going forward with evidence or burden of proof in terms of a burden of persuasion?
Your Honor, there the question that was posed to the administrative law judge was whether the appellant voluntarily quit or whether he was discharged because of misconduct. The appellant was able to show his burden of proof by indicating that he did not voluntarily quit. It was then that the burden of persuasion moved to JBS as the employer to be able to show whether there was misconduct and whether that misconduct was sufficient enough to be able to disqualify him from unemployment benefits.
Do you disagree with the concept that the appellee can meet its burden of proof from the evidence produced by your client?
No, Your Honor.
And what's your proposition for that idea, that it cannot be satisfied by the evidence your client presented?
Your Honor, if that burden of proof were to be placed on my client, the appellant, that would be a due process issue. They would not have the ability to present evidence in a way to be able to defend itself. They'd essentially be prosecuting themselves to be able to show why they wouldn't be entitled to benefits. They aren't able to cross-examine witnesses. They aren't able to do those types of areas that you would obviously be doing in any other type of case.
Does that concept actually shift the burden of proof to your client?
Forgive me for not understanding the question.
If the evidence that your client put on can also be utilized by JBS or the other side of this particular case, does that mean the burden has been shifted somehow to your client?
I don't believe that it would, Your Honor. And that's just because in this instance, the appellant's burden was simply to be able to show whether or not he voluntarily quit. And he did meet that burden. And so once it's a determination of whether there should be a disqualification of benefits, and if it was to such a level that he shouldn't receive those benefits, that would then be placed on JBS. And I think some really important things to be able to consider is that both JBS and the Department of Labor in their briefs acknowledge that JBS has this burden of proof. The Department of Labor in its argument to the district court also said, yes, the burden of proof is on the employer to be able to show this.
Is it misconduct?
Yes, that does go to the issue of misconduct.
So the initial burden would be on your client to show that he should receive benefits. And that burden shifts to the employer or the department to say that there was misconduct that disqualifies him for benefits?
I think that there's just a little bit more nuance. So the initial burden of proof on the appellant is actually that to show that he did not voluntarily quit his position. Correct. So once he's able to be able to show that, then the burden to be able to determine whether he engaged in misconduct and if that's sufficient to be able to deny him benefits, that's when it shifts.
So the initial denial was based on voluntary leaving the workplace, is that correct?
That's correct. And the administrative law judge determined that the appellant did not voluntarily quit his position.
So the issue of misconduct is raised by who?
The issue of misconduct, at the time when notice was given, the administrative law judge indicated that the determination was whether the appellant voluntarily quit or whether he engaged in misconduct. So it is his responsibility to be able to do that. However, it's not his burden of proof to then step in as JBS to be able to show that burden of whether or not he engaged in misconduct.
This case evolved, did it not, from a denial based on voluntary and then at the tribunal discharge for misconduct?
That's correct.
How did that happen, and would those require different proofs or different burdens at these different levels?
I believe that happened once there was, I mean, it's not like they delineated, hey, guess what, you met your burden, we're going to move on to what the other burden would be. But I believe that it was met just based off of the evidence that was provided by my client, which is exactly what he did.
At the initial
appeal in front of the administrative law judge, yes.
And was he represented by counsel at that hearing?
Yes, I represented him at that hearing. One thing that is really important to be able to acknowledge is that in the transcript on pages 33, 34, and 35, these were three notices that were sent to both parties, or excuse me, to all parties, and it says, quote, everyone who is a party will have the opportunity to testify and to present evidence. It is important that all parties participate.
But the regulations do not require either the employer or the department to attend the hearing. Is that correct?
That's correct. The regulations...
What do we make of that? How can we give effect to that regulation and still find in your favor?
I understand, Your Honor. So they may not be required to attend, but that doesn't mean that they still don't have a burden of proof. Those are two different things. So if they choose not to attend, that's totally on them. But they also still have to make a... The court then has to make a determination based off of the evidence that's presented with the issue where the burden is there. And so because my client, as the appellant, appeared for the hearing and he was able to be able to meet his burden, he was able to show that he did not voluntarily quit. Likewise.
Did the ALJ do something incorrect by asking your client about this misconduct?
I don't believe that it was inappropriate for him to be able to ask the circumstances that may have been involved. However, and he's able to be able to do that, to be able to get that type of information.
If you ask those questions, receive those answers, but the other side doesn't show up, is he to disregard those answers?
I don't think that he has to disregard those answers, but he only has to frame them as far as the burden that is meant. I would like to reserve the remainder of my minute for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kano, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Kano on behalf of John Albin, Commissioner of Labor, and the Nebraska Department of Labor. I wanted to start by clarifying how this became an issue about misconduct. In the transcript of documents, page 14 is the notice of telephone hearing. The issue set out to be hearing is whether the claimant voluntarily left their employment without good cause or was discharged for misconduct connected with the work. And so when there is a disqualifying separation determination, the notice of hearing gives the appeal tribunal jurisdiction to consider the nature of the separation, whether it was voluntary or involuntary. And if it is determined to be an involuntary separation, the issue becomes misconduct. If it is determined to be a voluntary separation, the issue becomes good cause.
Who identifies the issue for the hearing notice?
The department uses standard hearing notices that correspond to the determinations being issued. They are issued by the appeal tribunal and sent to all parties in advance of the hearing so that the parties have notice of the issues.
So the department identifies the issues for the hearing?
Well, the Nebraska Appeal Tribunal. So the appeal tribunal is housed within the Department of Labor but is separate from the adjudication unit, and it is the appeal tribunal in the department.
I beg your pardon. So if the initial determination was based on voluntary or involuntary, goes to the tribunal, right? Did the tribunal on its own accord expand the issues?
No, Your Honor. The tribunal didn't on its own accord expand the issues in this case. What happens in every unemployment claim comes with a separation adjudication. And there are two ways that a separation can become disqualifying. It can either be a voluntary quit or a discharge for misconduct. When an adjudicator of the Department of Labor makes a disqualifying determination and that is appealed, the issue for hearing by the appeal tribunal is whether the separation was disqualifying or non-disqualifying. And because there are two ways that the issue can be disqualifying, both of those are within the scope of the notice of hearing that goes out as soon as the appeal is filed. So there was no expansion of the scope of the issue. The scope of the issue is whether the separation is disqualifying, and those are the two ways that a separation can be disqualifying.
What kind of way is given it to the initial hearing then, or the initial determination?
There is no weight given to the initial determination. The hearing record is the basis for the appeal tribunal's determination. So there's no weight given to the initial adjudicator's determination. The parties are given notice and they come and they present their evidence.
Is this process that you've described set forth in some statute or regulation, or is this just the department's practice?
224 Nebraska Administrative Code 1 sets out the procedures for unemployment benefit appeals and talk about how a notice of appeal is filed after an appeal of a determination and the role of the tribunal in adjudicating that. Your Honor, it doesn't specifically talk about the language of the notice of hearing that will be that's a more specific implementation of those regulations, but it is 224 Nebraska Administrative Code 1 that sets out the role of the appeals tribunal in reviewing determinations and sets out that the evidence that is considered is the evidence presented at that hearing and not, there's no consideration under those regulations given to the information that the adjudicator might have considered in the first instance. It's a new hearing.
Counsel, I can't see the clock. I don't know which time you have left.
A minute and 14 seconds, Your Honor. So, of the 5 minutes that I have for my part. Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The Department of Labor's position is that the regulation clearly sets out that a hearing and decision on the merits occurs whenever a appealing party appears. And so this is... The Department of Labor has discretion under 48635 to set rules and regulations. Those are the rules and regulations set by the commissioner, and they are consistent with the nature of the unemployment benefits appeal hearing at which the appeal tribunal has an active duty of inquiry. And so it doesn't, the burden of proof the Department of Labor agrees is on the employer on the issue of misconduct insofar as the employer bears the risk of non-persuasion. In the absence of evidence or if things are in equipoise, we agree that the employer bears the burden of non-persuasion, but there is no rule that an employer has to come forth with evidence. There is no rule that the employer, that the tribunal can't make a finding of misconduct based on evidence presented by the claimant or evidence gathered by the appeal tribunal as part of its active inquiry duty. And so the Department of Labor's position is that the burden is a risk of non-persuasion on the issue of misconduct that does rest with the employer, but the appeals tribunal correctly used its active duty of inquiry to gather the relevant information, and a decision needs to be made on that fully gathered information. With that, I will turn the rest of my time over to counsel.
I do have one more question. I beg your pardon, and I'm sorry to your colleague here. On the active duty of inquiry, does that result in a report or a thing that's presented?
Well, it's the findings of fact. So the active duty of inquiry is within the context of the hearing, not outside of the hearing. But to get the regulations, which are based on guidance from the United States Department of Labor, place an active duty to gather reasonably available evidence on the hearing officer.
The evidence is shared with the claimant prior to the hearing?
The evidence is adduced during the hearing. Mm-hmm. So there's no active duty of gathering outside the context of the hearing. Per the regulations, it happens in the hearing by questioning the parties and witnesses that do appear.
In this instance, the only witness that appeared was the applicant.
That's correct. And so the only evidence that was considered was evidence from the claimant. The hearing officer asked questions to elicit information about the nature of the discharge, the reasons for it, and the Department of Labor's position is that that evidence needs to be considered on the merits to determine whether it affirmatively supports a finding of misconduct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Horvatich, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ruth Horvatich and I represent the appellee, JBS Swift Company. The only issue before this court is whether the district court erred in determining Mr. Badawi was discharged for misconduct which disqualified him from unemployment benefits. The district court affirmed the Nebraska Appeal Tribunal decision that Mr. Badawi was discharged for misconduct. That review was on a de novo review of the record. This court reviews the district court's decision for errors appearing on the record. It's also important to note that while the court and Ms. Cano pointed out that while there's no weight given to the initial determination for unemployment, there actually is some weight that's given to that ALJ decision, the decision where the hearing was held and the evidence was adduced. And this court has held that there's a rebuttable presumption of validity that attaches to the actions of the administrative agencies, to the actions of the ALJ with the Department of Labor.
Is there anything in the record as to why your client did not appear, and is that relevant to our ultimate decision?
There's nothing in the record as to why my client didn't appear, and it is not relevant to your ultimate decision. The rules and regulations of the administrative agencies clearly provide that the commissioner, or the ALJ in this case, needs to make a decision based on the evidence received from the appealing party, and that if any of the responding parties, which would have been my client, fails to appear, the appeal tribunal will proceed with the hearing and render that decision based upon what is heard at the hearing.
What is the active duty of inquiry, and how did your client benefit or not benefit from that concept?
The active duty of inquiry is with respect to whether or not he was disqualified from unemployment benefits. And like Ms. Cannell pointed out, there's two ways that an individual can be disqualified from unemployment benefits. One is if they voluntarily terminated their employment, and the other is if they were discharged for misconduct. And so the ALJ's job is to determine whether or not one of those events took place. Now, my client did benefit a bit from Mr. Badawi's testimony because his own testimony reflected that he was, in fact, discharged for misconduct. And that was all based on Mr. Badawi's testimony, and that's consistent with the rules for the ALJ to make that determination.
The department, as I understand the briefing, has suggested that the district court perhaps applied an incorrect standard when considering misconduct. And the department suggests that when misconduct is refusing an order from the employer, the proper inquiry is whether the employee refused an order that was both legitimate and reasonable. Do you agree with that, with the department's characterization in that respect?
I do not agree with the department's characterization of that, and I also would like to point out that the Department of Labor is an appellee in this case and prevailed in the district court below. This is not their appeal. This is Mr. Badawi's appeal, and there's no assignment of error with respect to the reasonableness standard that the Department of Labor is proposing, so that's not before this court.
So you don't believe that misconduct has any reasonableness component to it at all?
Misconduct is clearly defined in the case law from this court, and there's four things that it can consist of, and reasonableness is not part of those four things. And it may come into, and I'm out of time, can I finish my thought?
You certainly may.
While reasonableness may play some role in the judge's determination as to whether the actions constitute misconduct under this court's legal precedents, there's no requirement that a specific finding of reasonableness be made. Rather, individuals in the unemployment context conduct can be considered as misconduct that disqualifies them from unemployment benefits if it's wanton and willful disregard of the employer's interests, deliberate violation of rules, disregard of standards of behavior which the employer can rightfully expect from the employee, or negligence which manifests culpability, wrongful intent, evil design, or intentional and substantial disregard of the employer's interests of the employee's duties or obligations. It's our position that the district court did not err in determining that the conduct in this case actually did constitute misconduct under that standard.
Chief, I know we're out of time. May I ask one more question?
You certainly may.
Counsel, with respect to misconduct, what do we know from our record about the employer's rule regarding an employee to take on alternative duties? Where can we look in the record to see what that rule entails so we can decide whether it has been complied with?
The rule itself is not in the record. I do not have the Bill of Exceptions page with me right now as to where Mr. Badawi, he admitted that he knew that there was a rule that employees were required to fill in for other employees on a temporary basis in their absence.
Well, is filling in the same as doing both your job and another employee's job?
Yes, it would be JBS' position that yes, it is.
Where in the record would we look to find that in the employer's rules?
The employer's rules are not in the record, and it's not defined.
Thank you.
Okay, there are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
15 seconds, John.
How many seconds?
53.
53. Thank you very much. Mr. Anderson, we will give you all of 2 minutes.
Justice Stacy, to answer your earlier question about where in the record it shows what his job description is, that would be in the Bill of bill of exceptions with the administrative law judge, starting at page 11, line 19 to page 12 to line 8.
Thank you.
It's important to be able to realize that what the appellant was asked to do was highly unreasonable. He was asked to do two full-time jobs by himself. That's unreasonable. He did not act in any way that was misconduct towards JBS. He was merely trying to do the job that he was trained and oriented to do.
Was he requested to do that forever, or was this some kind of temporary request?
It's unclear whether this was a temporary request. However, in his training and in the orientation, it indicates that he was trained to be able to do a single person's job and that he was not supposed to do the job of the person in front of him. And that follows. If you're going to do something with large animals and a knife for 40 to 50 hours per week, that's exhausting. It's already a disgusting job to begin with. And the administrative law judge, he should not be adducing evidence to be able to satisfy the burden of proof that is on the employer. Many of the questions that you're asking JBS, they could have presented at this hearing, and again, they chose not to attend, and that was their burden.
So do you think there is no such thing as an active duty of inquiry?
I believe it's appropriate for the administrative law judge to be able to do that active inquiry, but it doesn't mean that he can then satisfy the burden that's on the employer.
Now, I got a little confused. Does an active duty of inquiry result in the same piece of evidence, or what?
Forgive me, did I say thing, Your Honor? I suppose I don't understand.
Being casual, but what active duty of inquiry results in what?
It would result in them at least being able to find out more information, at least in regard to whether or not it was appropriate.
They obtain information and then the department presents that at a hearing?
I believe that it was appropriate in order to be able to make the determination on whether or not my client actually voluntarily quit, which he did not do because he met his burden by appearing at the hearing.
When they're talking about working two jobs, do they ask him to work more hours because of that? Or just take two steps in the civil rights process?
It's my understanding that they weren't asking him to do more hours. He was going to be doing work. Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I complete?
You may.
Okay, thank you. They were asking him to be able to do an additional job within that 40 to 50-hour time span. So he had the demands of two full-time individuals during that time.
Does the record show whether he asked him same number of animals?
It does not, but this was not a mere additional task. This was a second full-time job. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. That then concludes arguments in Badawi versus Albin, and hence the court is adjourned and counsel.